Dogs are friendly, cats are aloof. Dogs eat what you feed them, cats are notoriously picky. By pet standards, dogs are smart and trainable, cats not so much. So why are cats more popular? According to our next guest, almost a third of American households have at least one cat. Search YouTube for cute cat videos and you'll get 4.6 million hits. But John Bradshaw, a British scientist who spent 20 years studying cats, says most humans don't understand how cats think. In fact, Bradshaw says, we may be demanding more from our cats than they can deliver. Worse, by neutering so many males, we may create generations of felines that are nastier than their forebears. John Bradshaw reports on the latest scientific findings on cats, coming up on Midday after the news. Hello again, one and all, and welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Rodrigues here on WYPR. Do you enjoy cuddling with your cat on the sofa on a cold winter day? Would it surprise you to know that little Fluffy is only one evolutionary step from her ancestors, the wild cats that roamed Africa 10,000 years ago? Yep, cute little Fluffy is a predator at heart. According to our next guest, the main difference between Fluffy and her ancestors is that she tolerates you. In a fascinating new book called Cat Sense, John Bradshaw notes that most of the contemporary cat owners value them for affection. Yet during most of their history, domestic cats have earned their keep as controllers of mice and rats. The ancient Egyptians venerated their cats, yet they killed millions of them, mummified their bodies, and sold them to temple visitors as offerings to the gods. Although they were valued for their rat-catching abilities during the Dark Ages, John Bradshaw writes, the Catholic Church associated cats with Satan, especially black cats. As a result, he writes, millions of cats were tortured and killed, along with many of their female owners suspected of witchcraft. Today, house cats are on a popularity roll. Dogs may be friendlier and more trainable on the whole, but pet cats still outnumber them 3-1 worldwide. In fact, almost a third of American homes have at least one cat. That's one reason a YouTube search that we conducted for cute cat videos turned up 4.6 million hits. That's 4.6 million videos. Because of their feral roots, John Bradshaw argues, cats need to be socialized with people from an early age, or they may never develop affection for their owners. Also, owners of one cat should be careful about introducing more cats into the household. Unlike most dogs, cats don't always play well with others. John Bradshaw delves into the physiology as well as the psychology of cats, from their two noses to their ability to see in low light to their uncanny sense of balance. It's fascinating stuff whether you're a cat lover or not. John Bradshaw is foundation director of the anthrozoology. I'm going to ask him about that word. Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol in England. His first book was a New York Times bestseller, Dog Sense. He's followed that up this winter with Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. It's available from Basic Books. John Bradshaw, we welcome you to Baltimore, Maryland, Midday at WYPR. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Your first book, as I just said there, was the bestseller about dogs, and you waited until now to produce this well-researched book about cats. So I'm going to ask you right out, just so our listeners know what we're dealing with here, who they're getting, and a straight answer here, please. Are you a dog person or a cat person, John?
Oh, I'm both. So I'm not going to give you the—I'm not going to come down on one side or the other. They are, as you said in your introduction, they're very different kinds of animals. I think, you know, to people who don't know either of them, they're kind of interchangeable. But if you want an animal companion that dotes on you and is always affectionate to you whenever you wish him to, or her to be, then a dog is right for you. If you're looking for someone to live life alongside you and still be affectionate, but been able to live its own life as well, and you may even value its independence, as I do with my cats, then a cat is the right animal for you. So it's very much, if you forgive the pun, horses for courses.
Okay. And now I want to ask you also about, I love the word anthrozoology or anthrozoologist. I don't know if I've run across that term before, so if you don't mind my asking about this, this branch of science?
Yeah, it's the study of human-animal interactions, and it goes back. I mean, it was probably first started in America, around in Boston, specifically in Boston, about 30 years ago. It's now spread worldwide. There are many university and college courses in anthropozoology now right across the world, not only in the United States and the United Kingdom, but in Australia and New Zealand, and many other parts of the English-speaking world. So it's a subject that I think fascinates many people. It obviously has a kind of link with animal welfare, which again is a modern concern, but it's slightly different because it's as concerned with the people, the owners, as it is with the animals. So it looks at that, the way that the two get on together.
Yeah, I was a little surprised at the figures came across in your book on cats versus dog, that cats actually outnumber dogs worldwide as pets. So that would mean the dog isn't really man's best friend if you go by the numbers. So why have cats become so popular?
Well, there are a huge number of cats around the world that are not really owned. I mean, they're kind of associated with people, but because they don't usually do very well if they don't have people around, but they're not really what you or I think would call a pet cat. When it comes to the genuine pet that lives in somebody's home, it's probably about equal numbers in some countries, slightly more in others, slightly more cats. Mm-hmm. But there are a great deal more independent or semi-independent cats than there are dogs. But dog is man's best friend. I think that can't be taken away from the dog because of the way dogs perceive us. They really do perceive us as being their best friends. They're very, very strongly attached. It's the reason that we've been able to train them and use them for so many different purposes, you know, down the ages, for hunting and herding and not just as companions. So, and the reason we're able to do that is because they are very fond of us. They like to associate themselves with people and become extremely fond of them very quickly. Whereas cats are a much more independent animal. So even if there may be slightly more cats than dogs, I think dog is still man's best friend.
John, that word independent keeps coming up, always with cats, always associated with cats. So I think this would be a great place for you to explain why that is, what it is about the cat's nature that makes it independent, a little less social, more able to sort of just be on its own and not bother with people so much, yet live in our environments.
Well, I think it goes really back to the cat's origins. The wild cat in Africa and Western Asia, which is what our domestic cat is derived from, is a pretty solitary animal. It has a territory. Each individual animal will have a territory. They don't get together very much except in the mating season. They spend most of their time alone. The reason for that is that they need to have a decent sized territory for hunting, which they don't want to share. Otherwise, they'll run short of food. So during the course of domestication, we have made cats slightly more dependent on us particularly, but also better able to get on with one another. But nevertheless, I think we've actually valued their independence. I mean, when you use a dog to, in the old days, we used to use dogs to clear out vermin, terriers, that sort of thing. It was very much done as a partnership between the dog and the person. Whereas, and they do it together, whereas with a cat, we just kind of expect them to get on with it on their own at night, mostly. So we've valued that independence. We've helped the cat to retain that independence because it was extremely useful to us. It was an animal which can wriggle in and out of all sorts of tiny crevices and chase after the rats and mice that are giving us trouble. Has been historically a very valuable animal. Of course, that is changing now. We don't value it so much nowadays. But many thousands of years, cats, we've actually wanted cats to be independent because they could do their job best that way.
So I'm curious about this then, how we got the cat to come in from the cold, so to speak. Like most wild animals, the way you describe them there, as predators out there on the hunt, they ignored humans or stayed away from humans, but then they kind of gave up their natural wariness toward humans. And so why was that? When did that happen?
Well, I think they did that themselves. I think it was a passive process. I don't mean a cat one day sat down and thought, wouldn't it be a good idea to team up with the humans over the hill? Mm-hmm. But, what we did, what we started doing around 10,000 years ago as the human race was to start storing food. And in quite appreciable quantities. And quite soon after that, we see an almost brand new animal appearing, which was the house mouse. And that thrived very quickly in areas, obviously, where we were storing food. So we almost had an almost instant piece of evolution of a new animal, which became a great nuisance to us very quickly. Now, the cats that did live over the hill would have been keeping an eye on this kind of thing, and because they're always looking for opportunities for new hunting grounds, and they would have realised that there were plenty of prey, easy pickings perhaps, near us. And so they would have initially just come in and kind of raided the mice that were around us and then run off again, a bit like a raccoon or something. But some of them evidently stuck around. They found that they could actually tolerate being near people, whereas the majority of wild animals, as you rightly say, do not tolerate that. And the ones that could tolerate being near people were more successful because they didn't have to run home. They could actually make their home near where the food was. And then subsequently, another stage occurred where cats being naturally suspicious of other cats, they had to tone that down a bit in order to be successful, because as our villages and towns, or as our villages grew into towns and the sizes of the food stores increased, the number of mice increased, so there was plenty of food for several cats, not just one. And so the cats that could actually kind of cooperate a little bit, or at least tolerate one another, were the ones that won out and were more successful. So initially it was nothing that we did. I don't think there was any conscious process going on, or a deliberate process going on our behalf. It was the cats changing their ways and evolving to suit this new opportunity that we gave them.
I love this story. Humans started growing maize. Some people call it corn or whatever grain, wheat or whatever, barley, rye, and then started storing it. And this little thing called a mouse started showing up in great numbers and eventually providing an all-you-can-eat buffet for these cats. And the cats had to learn to cooperate and stand in line at the all-you-can-eat buffet, so to speak.
Yeah, that's about it. I mean, the mystery to us is why other animals wouldn't do it. I mean, you've got weasels and stoats and that kind of thing, which could possibly have done it. They were in the right place. They are good, effective predators. But for some reason, and I don't think we'll ever know why, it was the cat that made a success of it.
Hey, John, those wild cats that we're referring to here, the ones that came to the village to take advantage of this new feast of rats and mice, what did they look like? How do they compare in size to the house cats we know today?
Well, there's some discussion about that. Some of the remains of these cats may suggest that they were substantially larger than most modern house cats are, but in other areas, they seem to have been much the same size. So in appearance, they wouldn't have been radically different. If you compare a Labrador with a wolf, you know, they really look very, very different, and you wouldn't ever mistake one for the other. Whereas a photograph of a striped tabby cat, because that is that's the normal wild type coat colour, a striped tabby and a wild cat, if you saw them in the distance, apart from the fact that one of them would be running towards you, meowing, and the other one would be running away, you probably wouldn't be able to tell the difference very easily. All the coat colours that we have, the blotch tabby, which is more common in the United States than the striped one, the black, the white, all of those, ginger, all of those came afterwards. They came as part of domestication. But the original colour, the striped tabby, is still very much the same as the wild version.
We'll take our short break here, John. When we come back, more of our conversation with John Bradshaw, author of Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. We have to get into that with John. You can give us a ring, 410-662-8780. If you have a question for John Bradshaw while he's with us, our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309 for a live talk here on Midday. And our email address is midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. We're having our conversation with John Bradshaw, British anthropologist and author of Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. It's from Basic Books, chock full of interesting facts about your cat and how you came to make sure it has the optimum environment. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. I have some questions pop out, John. I wanted to ask you about cats and tree climbing. Cats and tree climbing. There seems to be some dispute about the cat's tree climbing abilities. One has an image of a fire department, volunteer firefighters going out to rescue some cat that knew how to climb up a tree but didn't know how to climb down a tree. What's the story with that?
Well, it's true. I mean, cats are very good at climbing up trees. Their claws face backwards. So as they climb up, they dig the claws in. The claws are useless to act as brakes, so coming down again is a bit of a problem. I think the reason that young cats particularly get stuck up trees is perhaps because they're just too excited and they're running around all over the place and eventually end up a tree. But more often than not, they think they're frightened of something. They've been chased by something, or they think they're being chased by something. Going up high is a cat's natural instinct to get away from something that it's a little bit scared of. And so they may go up a bit higher than they needed to and then realize that they don't actually know how to get down again. So over here in the UK, our fire departments have decided they are not going to rescue cats from trees. It's the job of the humane societies to do that. So we don't get the fire engines out anymore. But most of them do eventually find their way down. You'd think it would be straightforward for them to just turn around and come down backwards.
Right.
And one or two cats do seem to be pretty good at doing that. They must have learned at some point. But many of them just kind of sit at the 20 feet up and howl miserably and hoping that somebody's going to come and help them. They do eventually come down. And cats are very good at breaking their fall. They're very good. They can almost parachute their way down if they do happen to fall from a high branch. And it's pretty unlikely that they will hurt themselves when they land, particularly if, you know, they're kind of landing on the forest floor. Landing on concrete's a bit of a different matter, but if they're underneath a tree, hopefully they're landing on something fairly soft. So I think although it's pitiful to hear, for a while, it's probably the best advice is to leave the cat there and it'll probably find its own way down. If it's still up there 24 hours later, then maybe you do need to call out the fire department.
One of the reasons people say cats have 9 lives is that they can survive falls like you're describing. So, you know, how did they do that? Do they always land on their feet? Is that true?
They always land on their feet if they fall far enough. That kind of sounds like a paradox, but they have to, particularly if they slip, they'll often end up initially falling with their backbone first and the legs upwards, which is clearly a disastrous way to land and can cause a great deal of injury. So in fact, if the fall is perhaps 6 feet or something like that and onto a hard surface, the cat does not have time to prepare itself for landing and can actually injure itself more than a fall from, say, twice that height, because they are able to twist around midair. They're quite remarkable set of reflexes that do it. I don't think they do it consciously. I don't think they know what they're doing. I think just Mother Nature kicks in. They rotate their heads and then their front legs and then their back legs by sort of alternately tucking one up and spinning the other one around. They spin their tails in the opposite direction to stabilize the fall. And so pretty quickly, within probably 6 to 10 feet of falling, starting to fall, they're actually the right way up with their legs extended and their back arched, which is the best posture to cushion the fall. The most likely injury, believe it or not, the most common injury from cats falling is not broken limbs, it's a broken jaw, because the head is very heavy, and as the cat lands, they sometimes can't actually prevent their bottom jaw from hitting the ground. For some reason, I don't think there's any particular reason behind it, the cat's lower jaw is actually quite fragile. And so it's a common thing for veterinarians to have to do, to wire a cat's lower jaw after it's had a fall. But the recovery is usually pretty much complete.
John Bradshaw is our guest in this hour of Midday. Cat Sense is his book. We're talking about the new feline science. We'll get into more of the science during this hour of the show. You're welcome to call with a question, and we'll get to the phone lines in just a moment to take questions for John. 410-662 8780, our number for Midday, our email address, midday@wypr.org. And John, before I go to the phone lines to take questions for you from our listeners, I want to go back to the history just a bit. So we have wildcats coming into human villages to take advantage of the rats and mice that they're finding there, the food that they're finding there, the protein that they're finding there. So I wonder, you know, do humans recognize that this is a this could be useful? These animals could be useful to them as exterminators. But when did humans begin to sort of appreciate cats, or even breed them for, I guess we'd call it non-predatory qualities?
Well, the ancient Egyptians both treasured cats for their abilities to keep vermin at bay. And I think certainly once they started writing about it, one of the things that they most valued cats for was their ability, apparently, their ability to kill or at least deter snakes. I mean, if you were living in Egypt at that time, I guess snakes were a real hazard, particularly for children. And so having an animal around your house that would at the least scare the snakes away, even if it wasn't actually able to kill them, would have been a great thing. And certainly they wrote a lot about the wonderful cats. If they found a cat that would kill snakes, it was something that they clearly valued very highly. So by that time, we therefore know that cats were living in the family. They weren't just skulking around the barns outside. They were living in the house. They were occasionally, even 5,000-6,000 years ago, seemed to have been buried alongside their masters or mistresses, and not only buried themselves, but also buried with little bowls of food alongside them, as if, you know, for the afterlife. Mm-hmm. Not only is the person going to the afterlife, but the cat's going, and they're taking some food along with them. So they were definitely members of the family at that point. Quite how widespread that kind of thing was, it's difficult to know. I think we can just guess that it probably was, because looking at cats today, I don't think those cats were very different to the ones we have today. And, you know, cats are cute. Everybody loves to have, or many people anyway, love to have cats around. So even if the primary purpose for those animals to be there, the reason maybe that the father of the household was prepared to have some cats around, secretly he probably also thought they were really rather cute, and certainly his family would.
Let's take some calls for John Bradshaw, 410-662-8780. John, this is Rob in Baltimore with a question for you. Rob, welcome to Midday.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
My question is, I have a male tabby and a female who I got much later, who's much younger, and she's much smaller, but she's far more aggressive than he is and dominates the food dish. She will eat and leave, and then if she sees him go in the kitchen, she will go right in trying to protect the bowl and take it over. Now, I did get her as she had been a wild kitten that somebody had taken in for me.
You're wondering why the female dominates the male. It gets sort of to the question about, you know, cats, the way they react to others of their species, I guess, John.
Yes, and first of all, I'm guessing that the male, or that both of them have been fixed. So we talk about them as being male and female, but in reality, they're kind of somewhere in between. They're not, otherwise you would essentially have a lot of kittens around if neither of them had been fixed. But cats, like humans, have very distinctive personalities, and it's not at all uncommon for a small cat to be feisty and to some extent control the movements of a much bigger, more laid back cat. I think, you know, part of the reason that they can get away with this is because clearly you're there to look after both of them. Your older cat is probably pretty confident that even if he has to give way momentarily, he's going to get fed and he's going to get everything else he needs, provided he just takes a little time out when the younger cat is around. So I think that's a very common thing to happen. It's not really about how big you are, and it's not really about whether you're male or female. It's much more about the personality that you have. And I think the you kind of gave me a clue there as to your younger cat's personality, in that it's you know, it was originally maybe had a slightly rough time, it had to fend for itself, and maybe is slightly less trustful of other cats and indeed people than the average cat might be, just because of that slightly uncertain start. So we do know that these sorts of things can, the early experiences can go on to affect a cat's personality for pretty much the whole of its life. So I think that's quite common. And when people get a second cat, I think there is an assumption in many people's minds that the second cat will kind of just slide into the household and adopt the kind of underdog position. If you are going to introduce a new cat into your house, I think it's worth taking some advice from a veterinarian or from one of the humane societies about how to do that, because there are different ways of introducing cats to one another, and some of them indeed work a lot better than others. And you can end up with either two cats that are really kind of living in the same house but dividing it up between them, or you can end up with two cats that are really best buddies for one another, and I think most people would like to have the latter.
And there's a big difference there between cats and dogs in this regard. We'll come back and talk some more about that. John Bradshaw is a foundation director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol. He was author of the best-selling book Dog Sense and now Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. We'll take some questions for John after another short break. Our phone number for questions here on Midday is 410-662-8780. Our email address, again, you can write us a question that way, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to our conversation with John Bradshaw, a scientist who spent 30 years studying dogs and cats. He wrote an earlier book, very popular, called Dog Sense, now Cat Sense, published by Basic Books. We're talking about Cat Sense with John in this hour of the show, and we'll take some more calls with questions for him. 410-662-8780 is our number here. And John, I'll go right to the phone lines, take questions from our listeners. And I'm sorry, is it Allie? Yeah, Allie in Orchard Beach had a question about cat behavior for John. Hi, Allie.
Hi. We have had three cats. They all lived into their teens and had to be euthanized, and we're currently catless. But all three of them had the same characteristic, which was they would be on our laps. We were petting them. They're purring and doing that little kneading thing they do with their front paws. And everything is fine, going along swimmingly. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, they freak out, dig their claws into our hands, bite us, hiss, and run away.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And my husband says, we overstimulated them, whatever that means. Mm. But I've always wondered if it's something else, maybe static electricity or what? What causes that behavior?
Well, it is a mysterious piece of behavior. I think it's very common. It upsets a lot of owners because they think that that's the kind of cat hates them. I think the comparison is with a dog, where you go on tickling it behind the ears and it won't get bored. I mean, you'll get bored before it does. Whereas a cat has a limited kind of threshold for any kind of social interaction, really. They are quite solitary animals. They're particularly likely to do that if we start doing the stroking. So if a cat's not ready to be stroked, but you want to get that interaction going, you might sit down and start stroking the cat, which was already sitting on the couch. It won't tolerate that for very long, and it will probably either just get up and walk out, or some cats, like the ones you describe, actually do something a little bit aggressive, that do a bit of scratching. It's really about the tolerance that cats have for us, and it's something that I think that cat owners really just have to learn to live with, that you kind of ration it out. You don't go on and on and on stroking, because almost any cat will get to the point where it's saying, this is enough. I'm actually getting a little bit stressed by this. And we think it dates back really to their origins as very solitary animals, that they have come a long way from the wild cat. I mean, you couldn't get near a wild cat, let alone get to stroke it. Even a semi-tame one, they won't socialise to the extent that our domestic cats will. But they still got one foot in the wild, and so any kind of lengthy social interaction of any kind, really, especially if it's quite intensive, is really something they initially like, but then quite quickly becomes irritating. So the trick is to ration it and just to stroke them a little bit, and then wait and see whether they come back for more. And if they come back for more, then fine, do a little bit more. But let the cat make the moves.
I get you. Thank you, John. Here's another call. This is Carrie in Frederick. Carrie, welcome to Midday.
Hello, thank you.
Go right ahead, please.
Well, I have a cat, Annie. She's about 2 years old. She's just a sweetheart. And she has this activity that she likes to do with her cloth play mice. She'll pick them up in her mouth, and she'll carry them around the house, and she brings them to bed even. And I just wonder, what's her purpose? Is she giving them to us as a treat, or why does she do this?
A toy mouse. Hmm.
Yes, I've done a lot of research into this because one of the things we need to do, especially, I don't know if yours is an indoor-outdoor cat or just an indoor cat, but certainly for cats, many cats are kept indoors nowadays for good reasons. And we kind of need to know what they need to do, how we can keep them happy. So we've done a lot of study of cats and their toys. And it turns out that as far as we can tell, what they think they're doing is actually hunting. I mean, it's a very powerful instinct in the cat. It's something that we've kept going in them. We valued in them for most of the time we've lived with them, or they've lived with us. And so the hunting instinct is still very strong. We don't like to let them out. We don't like them nowadays to go hunting. If they do, we don't kind of don't approve, most of us. So giving them another outlet for that instinct is a good thing. And toys do seem to do that. When a dog is playing with a toy, we've done, again, research into that too. And what the dog is thinking is, this is a way of having a conversation with a person. The toy is just something in the middle, something which stimulates interaction with a person. So the dog will come running up to you with a toy and insist you play. But when cats are playing with toys, they're really in a world of their own. They think they're hunting. And so just as cats will maybe kill a mouse but then not eat it, bring it back to the den to feed it to their kittens, or simply bring it back to eat later. So they'll carry a toy mouse around with them, many of them. As you say, they bring him, put them on the bed, use them again the next day. I mean, I think that's the slightly unusual thing. Most cats that I know get rather bored with their toys, so you have to keep changing them, change the size, change the shape or whatever. So something mouse-like usually works best, but you know, there are all sorts of toys that are shaped like little fish or spiders or whatever, and they'll keep the cat's interest going. A cat that likes just one toy and keeps it for months and months and months is unusual, but on the other hand, I think it still just tells us that they're obeying their hunting instincts.
And speaking of hunting, John, the cat that returns to your home with a small bird or a dead mouse or part of one of those animals and deposits it on the kitchen floor, sitting there proudly for a moment, hoping that you'll notice it and not shriek. what's going on there? It's a trophy of some kind? Does a cat understand trophy?
Well, I don't think so. No, I think, and I think the cat looking proudly, I think this is mostly in our minds.
Oh,
and
sure.
We love to project emotions onto our animals. It's one of the part of the amusement that we get from having animals, whether
right.
it's a dog or a cat or anything else. But right. I think what the cat is doing is just retrieving the piece of food, the piece of prey, is bringing it back to somewhere safe, which is what many predators will do. They won't necessarily eat their prey immediately because they could be ambushed, to take one example. They'll take it back to somewhere safe. Now, when our cats get back into our homes, they can pretty soon remember, and if they can't remember, they can smell it, that the cat food you bought from the supermarket is actually a lot tastier than the thing they've just brought in their jaws. And so the mouse goes on the floor, the bird goes on the floor, and the cat ambles over to the bowl of cat food.
Thank you. I needed an anthropologist to explain this to me. Thank you, John. Here's Tom in Baltimore. You're on with John Bradshaw, author of Cat Sense.
Thank you. My fiance and I are planning to blend two families, one of which has a 4-year-old dog and the other of which has a 12-year-old beloved cat. My question is, Are there any good ways of melding these two species together? Any plans that we can make? Any things we can do ahead of time to ease that blending?
Yes, I think it depends a great deal on the previous experience of the two animals. If the dog has been brought up with cats, if the cat's been brought up with dogs, then it will usually go pretty well. I mean, they're not natural enemies, the two species. They probably were way back thousands of years ago when they were both kind of hanging around villages. But the modern pet animals don't have any reason to be, and in general, they have to really learn about the other species. The dog has to learn about cats, and the cat has to learn about dogs when they're very young, for that really to stick and make them more approachable. I think if you've got some, and it's great that you you're really planning this. A lot of people will just kind of do it as and hope that it works because there are so many other things on their minds. But if you can plan ahead, there's a great little tip that you probably haven't thought of, because it's not natural for us to think like this. Both animals, both dogs and cats, are creatures who rely a great deal on the sense of smell to tell them who's around, what's going on. You know, it's kind of almost like their newspaper. They go and sniff around the garden in the morning, and they'll learn a lot of what's happened overnight from the little smells that there are there. So if you can introduce the animals to each other by smell, first of all, so just take a piece of cloth, rub it on the dog's back, take it to the cat, take another piece of cloth, rub it on the cat's back, take it to the dog, switch those pieces of cloth around a few times, then when the two animals do eventually get to meet, they will already kind of know each other. They'll know of each other's existence. And so the shock of suddenly meeting another animal they don't know and weren't expecting, because, you know, we can't tell them that this is going to happen, they just have to experience it, then that having got that smell experience in advance will, I think, ease the transition. And the other one is to stop the cat from running away, put it in a safe environment, either cage the dog or cage the cat, so that they can kind of calm down and introduce themselves to one another. The problem with a cat is that they do tend to run off if they're uncertain, and particularly if they're scared. And once they got into the habit of running away from a dog, they'll carry on doing it. And so you really never get anywhere. So very gentle introduction. Use that smelting first of all, and try and stop the cat from running away without scaring it, obviously. And hopefully, and you know, it will work. And good luck to you.
John, in the time remaining, I'd like to go to the subtitle of your book, Cat Sense: How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. So what have you learned from the research, and what advice would you have from our listeners based on that?
Well, I think there's a number of things. I think we do need to look at the cat's hunting, you know, as I was just describing just now to one of your callers. We've done a lot of research into how cats can be distracted, if you like, from hunting, so they can go through their hunting repertoire, which is a very natural part of their behavior, without doing any real damage. And I think that's becoming increasingly important. There's a lot of pressure in the United States. I think about a year ago there was a report from the Smithsonian Institution which heavily criticized, especially feral cats, not so much owned cats, but people who feed feral cats, that those feral cats were doing a lot of damage to wildlife, and that really that should, you know, be looked at rather carefully. So people are increasingly keeping cats indoors, partly to stop them doing that, partly because they're worried about road traffic and that kind of thing. Partly some people get worried about their cats being kidnapped, although I think that's a little bit overplayed, except perhaps for the very expensive pedigree animals. But there's nothing intrinsically wrong with keeping a cat indoors. I think, you know, a few decades ago, we thought cats are wild, sort of semi-wild animals, and it would be cruel to keep them indoors. But experience has taught us that, in fact, they can live very fulfilled lives indoors, provided their owners provide them with outlets for their normal natural behavior, such as, you know, giving them plenty of playtime with a mouse on the end of a piece of string. And then, you know, the other message, I guess, is the one about we've studied cat social lives a lot, and they're quite remarkably sophisticated, considering where they started from, which is a very solitary animal only a few thousand years ago. But they're nowhere near as sophisticated as the dog is, and we do have to be very careful about introducing cats to one another. We've just talked about introducing a cat to a dog, but the same kind of thing, I think, should, you know, really happen every time. If somebody wants to get a second cat, they need to think very carefully about it and go through an introduction process so that the two cats will get along. Because stress, the research we've done into stress in cats has shown that, a lot of it is about other cats. It's about not getting on with the other cat in the house or the cat, the neighbor's cat or whatever. And that it's not just a kind of a question of the cat being slightly annoyed every now and again. They get very anxious. They get chronically anxious. This comes over and spills into real genuine medical problems, skin problems, cystitis, those sorts of things. So quite a lot of the medical problems that cats get are actually affected by social stress. And I think if we manage the relationships between cats better, we'd have healthier, happier cats.
John Bradshaw, thank you so much for your time today.
That's a pleasure.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to speak with you. John Bradshaw, author of Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet, has been our guest here on Midday. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in.